this is an oral history with Marla Ruskin. The interviews are Arnold Thackeray and Richard Sawyer on the 6th of March 1990. Marla, I'd like to start by asking you about your mother and father, about their education, their occupations, and literally the world that you were born into.
I guess I grew up in Los Angeles. Neither of my parents went to college. I wouldn't say it was an environment where there was great intellectual stimulation by any stretch of the imagination. It's been interesting finding among lots of people know us that they have an older brother who's a professor and quite successful, and that my parents, who, if anything, discouraged us, ended up with two professors.
What did your father?
My father is a plumber, and my mother's been a housewife, and that was very much the way it had to be.
And you have one brother?
I have two brothers.
Two brothers. Are they older or younger ones?
I have a brother who's a year older. He's a mathematician. And I have a younger brother who's currently going back to school for pre-med.
And the mathematician is a professor?
Mm-hmm.
Where is he?
Well, he's currently at Caltech, but he'll be returning to the University of Minnesota. Supercomputer.
Okay, and did you grow up in Pasadena?
No, I grew up in Alhambra, California, until I was about 10, and then my family moved to the San Fernando Valley, and that's where I finished school.
In a local town?
Yeah, Granada Hills. It was a fairly small town. It's where the earthquakes were in 1970.
And the...
I had a fairly standard education.
How big was the high school that you went to? How big was the graduating class?
The graduating class was about 2,500 or 3,000. It was quite a big high school. It was the largest west of the Mississippi.
Probably to the east as well. And when did your awareness of science first?
I guess I don't feel the most objective about that. But I asked an uncle of mine, who is, I would say, intellectual, cultured. We were talking not too long ago, and I was saying, well, did you know that I was interested in science when I was young? He goes, oh, yes, it was very clear. It was very obvious. We didn't go on. I think even in elementary school, I liked science, but no more than art. I mean, I did a lot of art in junior high. I took a lot of art courses. Junior high, I actually had a science teacher who had actually written the science program for the LA City Schools, who to this day is still very active sort of in her quest for knowledge. And she was a very strong supporter on my part, and actually mediated a lot between my parents, because my parents were opposed to women being in science, and she tried to convince them that it wasn't such a bad thing. To this day, I'm still extremely close to her. Both, she had two children who are professors, and so she had some clue as what the future was. And then I went to high school. I'd say that's where things changed a lot, and that I skipped part of high school. And my final year spent working in a lab at UCLA, a neurobiology lab. It was called the psychobiology lab. And that's when I discovered what neurobiology is, which is what I am now, neurobiologist. And I think from that time on, I've been hooked.
You were doing this while in
high school? Right, I was taking, I actually had an advanced placement science class in high school, and I don't remember the mechanism, but somehow, I don't know if it's formal, I was able to become a volunteer. It was at a VA hospital with UCLA staff professors. And they worked on sleep research, and it was a time when that was actually a fairly active, interesting area. And the project that I plugged into was on the effects of sleep deprivation. And I did very little for these people and sort of count spikes on charts and monitor the animals. But I'd say at the time it had a great influence on me. Not knowing what it meant at all at that time, I decided I wanted to become a professor. I knew no one who was.
What did your parents think about you going to college? Were they in favor of that or not?
Very much against it. Which actually partly accounts for where I went. You know, I didn't apply to college until very late. So when I applied, there was only a couple schools open. Irvine, which was a very good place. Actually, I started Irvine. I went my first 2 quarters to Irvine, UC Irvine, and then I got a visitation to Berkeley, so, which I guess is important with respect to this history. My 3rd quarter of my freshman year, I went to UC Berkeley, and I took an upper division neurobiology course. The professor teaching it went to him and asked if I could take his course, since I had placed at a biology and I had some background in neurobiology, so I thought. And he was not too pleased. He didn't want undergrad lower division students, but he agreed to let me come in as long as I would accept whatever grade I got. Again, to this day, he's probably, I consider him my sort of father in science. I mean, he's the person whose advice I trust the most. At the time, I didn't know that he was quite as revered as he is, but he's a stellar scientist, was then and continues to be, and has received many awards.
Who is that?
Gerald Westheimer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
I know his name, yeah. So he really...
I think he...
...noticed you.
Well,
You did reasonably well.
Yeah, I did well on the course, and because I was on a visitation program to Berkeley, it meant I couldn't get a transfer right away. I had to go back to Irvine for a quarter, which would be a theme in my life. I've moved a lot. And then I got a transfer that took me back to Berkeley. And at that time, I asked him if he would be my advisor. I became an independent major in neurobiology. At the time, there was no such major. I don't know what that ended me, but I decided I wanted to do it. I wanted to be neurobiology, which meant that I satisfied things that could have been physiology, zoology, and a number of other majors. But with him, I could design it around that. So by then, I think he took note of me. I think he knows my life better than I do. And if he wanted factual information, he would know it.
Now you're in Berkeley and you've got a mentor of some.
Although I had very little interaction with him then. I mean, I think I was raised to think that, at least I viewed the time that professors were gods, and I would never have gone in and just talked to him. I would have only gone in for an express purpose. You know, we talked to each other once a month or so. So I didn't have a lot of dealings with him. I'd go in and talk about my classes. He'd give me his thoughts. And
how were you financing being an undergraduate?
I suppose my parents. You know,
They weren't that opposed to you going?
Well, they basically knew I was going to leave home. If either I was going to go and work and make enough money to go myself, or they were, and to prevent that, they let me go to college. And the UC system, if you're a California resident, is quite reasonable. I mean, it wasn't a consideration to go someplace to a private school. My brother was at Yale.
It was okay for him.
Well, I let my parents deal with it. So that was his problem. My brother got the LA Times gives an award to the outstanding science student in Southern California, and he got that, which covered more than half his way to Yale, and then he got other awards. At the time, my parents said to him, "What's wrong with the junior college?" So, I mean, they never quite picked up on the significance. I think now they have some clue, and they definitely do. And they're actually, they're fairly contemporary people. Just didn't see things the way we did. So, and that was part of the problem. They felt at that time that the money ought to go to my brother, who was going to have to support a family and not me. So I lived with, you know, I lived with usually four people in a two-bedroom apartment, and it worked out.
And you decided you wanted to go to graduate school?
Right, except that I took a year off. I took some time off between undergraduate, graduate school. Partly I had no money. And at that point, my parents really were completely opposed to any further education. I'm Jewish, and I had a lot of guilt of taking their money and using it for things that they were not supportive, and I didn't want to feel like anything they gave me I had to owe them. So I felt if I made some money, I had enough to just sort of get me to the next spot, and I'd be better off. And I hadn't had a chance to work in a lab as an undergraduate at Berkeley. I tried many times, but if you're not on work study, it was pretty difficult to get into labs, at least the ones that I approached. So it seemed like a good time to pick up experience. I guess I had been admitted to graduate school, because again, I applied late. Well, when some professors found out I wasn't doing anything, they contacted various people at other universities. They said to send my information, and I got accepted to various places, and I decided that if I was going to do it, I was going to stay out a year and make sure that I'd sort of looked over all the places I'd be interested in, not just take some place by default. So I stayed in Berkeley and had three jobs, I guess. I worked as a research assistant to a linguist for a while. I was the secretary to a developmental psychology group who incorporated me into more than just secretarial services. And I took a job with Elizabeth Robles Einstein. I don't know if you know who she is, the daughter-in-law of Albert Einstein. So she's a neuroscientist, which is why I took the position. But I ended up doing mostly secretarial for her as well, and managing her Einstein affairs, which was a very interesting part of it. And during that year, I applied to graduate school. And by then, it was clear to me that when I interviewed at Washington University, which is where I ended up, that was exactly where I wanted to be. Partly because that's where Victor Hamburger was. Yes.
How did you know his work?
I think unlike a lot of, I'd say, our undergraduates, any of these people I've contacted, I had done a fair amount of reading of original papers during my year working. I took a graduate invertebrate neurobiology course, and it was all the professors I worked for agreed that I could take off any time I want for seminars and just make up the time. So it was all a lot of freedom. So I was being exposed to a lot during that time.
But you were working out for yourself.
Beg your pardon?
You were working out for yourself where you wanted to go and who you wanted to be with. You weren't.
Right.
It wasn't Gerald Westheimer saying, go to center.
No, actually, it was interesting in retrospect. Nobody sort of pointed me to schools at all. I mean, he would have been the person who would have given me the most input. And at the time, I don't think the people at Washington University were people he knew well, so that would not have been the place he would have just recommended. And I actually knew of it because I had a boyfriend who was going with an MD PhD program who didn't go, but through his, you know, to Harvard, through his sort of looking at the place and telling me what it was like, I decided to see what the neurobiology program is like. And that's actually how I discovered it.
Let's go back from that to your parents and stereotypes. The Jewish parents' ambitious for their children to succeed academically is such a stereotype. Then why didn't your parents conform to that stereotype, do you think?
It's a mystery to me. They're both very poor growing up. They came from very traditional, close religious families, although they're not religious, and I was raised with religious upbringing, but I don't practice it now. It's not clear. I think my mother was a very bright student that got married at 18 very, very willingly, had two children by the time she was 20, very willingly. My dad never wanted her to work, nor did she think she ought to work, and not because, you know, they had a lot of money growing up, and we couldn't. My mom didn't drive either, so we couldn't, you know, go places for music lessons. We couldn't do the things that I considered all my friends to do. And so both my brother and I know less about my younger brother, who I'm very close with, that what his upbringing was like. You know, we both sort of independently pursued our interests. And I took a lot of courses at a local park because I could walk there. And it's not clear because my parents have a lot of friends who are well educated, who wanted their children to go on and do things. My dad's older brother, who's probably the dominant sort of figure in the family, and certainly to me, when he was a very, very important person. If anything, I mean, it was the flip side. His children weren't so interested in academic pursuits or college, didn't do so well, and it meant the world to him. It's something that I haven't figured out. I mean, nobody who knows my parents can figure out.
Okay. Let's go to Washington University, and you were in the neural science department. Were they offering you financial support?
Right. And I could basically live off of what they gave us for a stipend. Mm-hmm. It was fairly reasonable to live in St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. And how many people were in the class attended?
It was a division of biology and biomedical sciences, and it was broken down into different programs. In the neuroscience program, I think there were probably 6 plus 2 MD PhDs that joined.
Okay. And
I know where most of them are.
Did most of them survive through the program?
Let's see. No, all of them did. Max Cowan was actually my chairman at the time. But I think about 3 dropped out, and unfortunately a few committed suicide. Not pleasant. And only the men have faculty positions, and none of the women but me.
How did you make your way to Joel Price's?
By default, I started in Wittgenhamburger's lab, which is even before going, I really thought very highly of his work. He was on main campus, so I don't know if the way that WashU structures the medical school campus, and there's Forest Park separates it from the medical campus. And I lived in dormitories by the medical school campus. So he agreed that I'd come into the lab, and I worked mostly with the postdoc that first year, part of the first year. I didn't have a whole lot of exposure to him because he was actually quite sick then. Do you know who Victor Hamburger is? Okay. He was not, it was a, actually a real low period for him. And so to increase my exposure, be able to have more interest with him, we set up a reading course. I actually met with him at least once a week for a while to discuss the papers he picked in neurobiology. When it came time to decide where to stay, well, one, you had to do rotations, which I was very much in favor of. But when it came time to make a decision, he basically said that I could choose whether to stay or not, but there's a good chance that he wouldn't be around when I finished, and I should think very seriously about that. So I decided it probably wasn't a very good idea to stay in his lab. That's one of the few mistakes, the few things I regret in life. And the next place I went was to work with a postdoc in Joel Price's lab, Lou Haberle, who's now at University of Wisconsin, to learn physiology. And I did that for the summer. I think it was partly not knowing, and that for various reasons I just stayed. It wasn't for my strongest academic interests. Partly is I thought I was going to be able to work on development in his lab. And there were a lot of really interesting things one could do working in the olfactory system, which is the area that his lab worked in. It turned out there were two other graduate students who had been there for a year, who were my year, but were ahead of me. And they had development projects. And when, after being there for another year, and we had to sort of decide for sure what each of us were going to do, he said I couldn't work on development. I figured it wouldn't be so bad to be out of there in 2 years. I had a project that was going well. I just wasn't thrilled about it. And I can get myself interested in anything if I'm involved. But it wasn't in development. It was pure adult organization. That's how I ended up staying.
Okay. And your thesis was actually about what?
The organization of connectivity in the olfactory system.
What sort of techniques were you using?
For the time, there were sort of new techniques, I mean, not a very standard. I was doing a lot of tracing of connections, so I used triturated amino acids as anterior grade tracers. I used HRP as retrograde tracers. And one of my projects that I picked was to look at the organization of what are referred to as the mitral cells, the projection neurons of the olfactory bulb to the olfactory cortex. And since the time of Cajal, there's been a question about whether a single cell has a widespread projection or whether pop small groups of cells have a widespread projection. About that time is when they're called fluorescent retrograde tracers came out. It was about 1979, 1980. Mary Swanson, who you may have heard of, had just come back from being in Europe where they were first used. And so I told my big bar of steel what he had to do the project. And so I worked with these fluorescent tracers, which at the time there was a handful of people in the country using them. now they're just very, very common.
The PhD, it took you 6 years, if I'm understanding. Was that about average?
In fact, I finished before the two people in my lab decided for me.
And you really, when did you decide you were keeping going? Going to do a postdoc and become an academic and do the whole business?
I think now I've decided, I'm not sure. I think that I decided to stay in graduate school because I actually had applied to Indy OD programs at Berkeley. So I've been accepted for a degree in optometry / PhD at Berkeley. And after that last year, I decided not to go my first year. And I reapplied. This is partly so that I could make enough money to support my parents when they got old. So once I decided that I didn't have to worry about that, that I could accept them before, that I decided to stay in graduate school, and then I don't think I've seriously questioned it since.
Mm-hmm. So how did you get to Stanford?
Very much by design. And when I knew all along I was interested in developmental neurobiology. As I was approaching the end of my at that time as a graduate student, and I thought about what kinds of problems I wanted to work on. And I was very certain that I wanted to make sure I was going to go to a lab, that I could work in the field I wanted to be in. And so I wrote and corresponded with several people. And unlike a lot of labs where the advisor sort of mediates the placement of their students, and I told my advisor after the fact what I was going to do, and I had sort of the good fortune of being accepted into the lab that I wanted to be at.
And what differences did you notice between the Stanford lab and the Washington U?
I think Washington U is a wonderful, wonderful institution. I think if I had any place a lot, it's staying at WashU. To this day, I have a lot of very close friends who were my teachers and friends from that time. I think they provided us with an excellent education, probably the best in the country. It was certainly rated one of the best neuro programs, but the way it was designed in that regard, I don't think there was a better place. For my own sort of pursuit of what I was interested in, Stanford was a better place for me because I was working on problems I cared more about. And in terms of sort of the quality of science and the sort of excitement of, around me, I think they're very comparable. And I was privileged in that way to have been at both places.
How large was Schatz's lab when you went
there? So when I got there, there was one graduate student. I think she'd been there about 3 years, maybe 2 years. And there was one graduate student who never finished.
That was pretty small.
Mm-hmm. It's very big now. It's probably 10 graduate students and postdocs.
And what you did there was a little bit different from what you've done in WashU.
Initially, it wasn't as different as I'd hoped it to be. And there's some irony in that. I didn't go to work with Pashka Rakesh at Yale, if you know who he is. The reason being is that the one thing that I didn't want to do was to do birth dating studies in the cortex, which means it used treated vomiting to label dividing cells and determine when they leave the mitotic cycle. And although I thought partial thought was really interesting, the last thing I wanted to do was that. Going to Carlos' lab, I wouldn't have to do that. Well, for various reasons, the project that I started with was to study the neurogenesis of the cat visual cortex. So I found myself in some ways not doing, using radically new techniques, but that led into a gold mine. So
gold mine.
And during the course of my first year there, so I discovered a population of cells that we now refer to as the subplate, to the transient population of cells in the developing cerebral cortex, present prenatally, disappears postnatally. It wasn't recognized before I found them, although I think several people could have seen it in their material. It's now, I'd say, one of the areas that people focus on a lot and that sort of talked about in basic course of developmental biology. It's the project that Sue McConnell worked on as a postdoc in Carlisle. I don't know if you've interviewed Sue McConnell yet.
Not yet. Okay.
I think so. And I don't think it was as clear at the time because I worried about whether I was missing something. It was a very sort of novel idea that you had massive cell death in the cortex, that you have a population of cells that serves a temporary function and completely disappears. There's no precedent for that in the nervous system. There was sculpting of cell populations in relation to target size, but nothing like this. And so I spent a lot of sleepless nights thinking, what am I missing? We're designing experiments to narrow it down better. And actually, it wasn't until Sue McConnell did some work this year that I finally really believed that they exist, even though I published on it.
You moved on in 1984. Why was that?
Because I thought that one should continue to learn new things and get new exposures. There was some influence of Dennis Baylor, who's a professor at Stanford who I admire greatly, who encouraged me not to think about jobs, but to get the best training before taking a position. And after finishing being in Carla's lab, I was fairly committed to studying the development of the cerebral cortex. And I thought at the time that if I was going to do that, I should learn more about its adult structure and function. So I went to Simon LeVay's lab to learn to do physiology.
Was there a year in between there?
No.
Oh, I think we may have a typo.
Okay, you went straight from one to the other.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I went to, I took a course at Woods Hole in that summer that I moved.
Okay.
It was, I think I left with some reticence because I already realized how much more there was to do on this population of cells, and it was just beginning to be clear that it was a wide open field and I had the lead in it.
Did you leave the work behind you or did you take it with you?
I had no choice.
You left it behind you. What do you think about that now, having to do that?
Well, I think for me, we'll get on to a few more moves. I think it hasn't been the best thing that I have dropped projects every move I made. I think I respected what the people that I worked with, said about how projects could or could not stay in the lab. And I think that if I have people who are going on, that I hope that I would let them take their projects. I think it was a time that, I don't think it was clear when I left that this sort of subplate population was going to be as interesting as it was. When I looked for jobs, two years after that, my whole lab was going to be based on studying the subplate. Carla's lab wasn't at the time. At the time, she had said that I could have this as mine, and that she wasn't going to go on. She would go on with it, but not. She wouldn't because I had found it and that I had known what was to be done.
But that changed into you can't take it with you.
Well, I didn't. Okay, when I went to Simon's lab, I wanted to continue to work on those cells to actually do physiology on them under his guidance. I couldn't do it on my own. And I don't think he wanted to be in a position whatsoever, although Carl and Simon had worked with each other in the past, of taking a project from Carl's lab into his lab. And so that was made clear immediately that I could not do that.
So it was a problem with both ends.
Yeah. I think I already knew that I wanted to continue working on those cells.
But you effectively had to drop it for a couple of years.
Well, I'd say forever. Yeah. In the way that I envisioned. I don't believe in competing with people who you know better than to compete with.
But the Schatz lab is still working on those.
There's probably five or six people working on it, and there are labs all over the world working on it now.
Don't you feel rather bitter about it?
I think I have in the past. I felt bitter when I wrote for jobs before I went in 86, and my whole thrust was to work on the subplate, and Carla knew that, and didn't tell me that she was switching the lab over to mostly that. I think I felt a little bit embarrassed that I would not have proposed to do the same thing that she was proposing to do, or a lot of overlap. I guess I don't see where, after a while, where bitterness gets you. So. I don't know. And I've always felt the senior person is going to win out. It's not to say, I mean, I'm in a very, probably a fairly competitive, controversial field right now. And people say, well, you know, how do you feel about so-and-so? And I say, well, I can't keep switching projects. I mean, I'm committed to this. Even if somebody else is doing it, I'm going to stay doing it because I'll see things differently, and I'll get nowhere if I were to just try to keep staking out areas that somebody else isn't in.
But
Carl is probably a very strong supporter and a very good role model. I mean, I have a lot of positive to.
So what did you do at Salk?
The Salk, I learned to do physiology and learned that I don't enjoy physiology. But it was, Stanford was a place where I made a lot of professional contacts and dear friends. So besides Carla's lab, which was good, to this day there are people there, John Nichols, who's, in fact, he was just came to visit in Emory last week, who I have a lot of interaction with now. Dennis Bailey, I have less interaction, but you know, very much benefited from my time spent with him. So the Salk was a place where my own research area, I wasn't particularly overjoyed with, but the people around, pretty good.
Benefit of hindsight, it might have been better to stay longer at Stanford.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
Did you move from Salt to back to WashU? Was that because the Salt experience wasn't going too well?
Well, it was for multiple reasons. I actually had a non-tenure track position before going to the Salk, which I decided not to take because I didn't feel I was ready to be at that level. Well, I left, and I decided that the Salk wasn't the place for me, that lab wasn't the place for me because I didn't want to continue doing that kind of research. It was the time that Max Cameron left the Salk, so it was not a time where you could actually appeal for continued support. I mean, there was a lot of instability. And again, I considered, okay, well, if I'm going to stay in science, what's the best thing to do? Do I just try to stay in San Diego and find the best possible position I can? Or do I, again, go wherever I can get the best training? So I had applied for jobs during that period and had been offered a job in Texas, which I might have taken, I don't know, but it got canceled because of the oil crisis. When the oil crisis came, they put a freeze on all state hiring since it was a state university. What would have been my job, I mean, it was all on paper except for not signed by the chancellor, evaporated. So I had originally made plans, and I was already working on it months before, to go work with Donna Chikarishi, who's a molecular neurobiologist at Tufts, who you might know because she's a senior Pew person. And I switched that and decided to go to St. Louis because Josh Sains had sort of just introduced a new method that had potential for the questions I was interested in. So I decided to go there.
Did that work out better?
I think Stanford was probably the place where I think I did what I consider very exciting work. I mean, I to this day am really excited by the kind of work I did in Carla's lab. And my return to St. Louis was very much the same. I had thought I was going to stay in St. Louis. I actually got very, very sick and spent a lot of time having surgery and being in the hospital. So that caused a lot of problems, and that it no longer became reasonable that I could stay on and write grants and have some independence but not have a tenure-track position. And since my work was going very well, nonetheless, I decided that I was going to go and find a job, that I didn't want to wait longer and set up my lab. If I couldn't do it there, then I was going to go elsewhere. So it was mixed. If I hadn't gotten sick, I would have probably still be there.
How did you find the job at Emory? Was that looking in science?
Yes. Unlike that, some people say you'll never find a job, and by answering advertisements, I believe that's the way to do it. And actually, I like to know that I get things because I deserve them, not because there was some connection, some favor, anything like that. So I wouldn't take any word of mouth. If somebody told me there's a job someplace that wasn't advertised as a full-fledged job, I wasn't interested. So yeah, I knew nothing. In fact, it was one of the few places I applied for a job that I didn't know people at. I knew it was considered a good university, but I knew no... Actually, that's not true. I knew one person there.
And what did they give you to help start up at Emory?
Much less than most people, $25,000.
Was that enough?
Not by a long shot. No. It was 25 sort of up front. And then I could write a BRSG grant, and I had to write a grant to get it for another $25,000, which I got after I was there, but it could not be guaranteed.
What grants do you have now?
Now I'm sort of fortunate. I have the Pew. I understand that my NIH started March 1st, although I haven't seen the money yet. I have a Sloan. I have a NATO grant. I have a university research fund grant for $10,000. Did I say an NSF? I have NSF coming. Yeah. So, as of the last month or so, the Pew actually did, well, it made a huge difference because it was the first big sum of money that I knew I was going to have to work with. I don't think I was envisioning how bad things could be if I didn't get it. And I wasn't planning on it by any stretch of the imagination. But actually last summer I had no money. I couldn't order anything. I basically had my hands tied for a while. Partly because Pew was supposed to activate on July 15th, but they didn't send the money till August 15th. And so I started teaching August 20th, it didn't.
What did the Pew do things for you beyond the simple fact of the cash?
I think that partly remains to be seen. I think this experience at the meeting has been extremely positive. And I guess I didn't really know much about the Pew before my chairman asked if I wanted to be considered. So the way Emory worked the Pew nominations, that every chairman got to submit a name, and then amongst the deans and council chairmen, they selected one person. And I don't think I was very aware of what the Pew was. And I thought, I couldn't imagine why I wasn't. Now I actually have several friends who do have them prior to this year. So, I think I immediately thought it was a very distinguished award, very prestigious award. Told my uncle that I couldn't imagine how I got it. And he said, well, do you think you could have deserved it? And I said, I suppose so.
What's the difference between being an assistant professor and being a postdoc?
A world of difference. I probably haven't been happier. I mean, I don't think I went in to being a professor knowing whether I'd like it or not, whether I'd, you know, I've never had to be responsible for setting up all the equipment to make sure it works. I didn't know if I'd get grants. I mean, it was very much an unknown. I mean, from the moment I got there, I think I've actually really enjoyed every challenge. I mean, it's every bit of it, it's been fun. Most people who know me would not have predicted that reaction.
How much teaching obligation do you have?
A fair amount. See, my first year, this is my second year there, I taught in human anatomy course. I gave lectures in a neuroscience course, gave lectures in an undergraduate biology course. I taught in an allied health histology and cell biology course, much more than I anticipated. And again, my chairman knows I wasn't pleased, and I don't think he realized that I was being asked to teach by people that he didn't know about. And I assumed that if these people were coming to me, that they checked it out with him. I mean, teaching human anatomy my first year was a surprise. When I got there, I was told that I had to teach. My labs weren't ready, so I spent August to December doing practically nothing but teaching. So it was a setback, but...
How many people are in your lab now?
Let's see. There was a pediatric neurology fellow who worked from July till December. And he was a joy to have. He was really wonderful. He left. He'll have a position in the pediatrics department come June, and will spend the next 5 years in my lab learning to become a scientist. I mean, he's very much well thought of by the clinical people, and they really want to do what it takes to build his scientific training. So he'll be in my lab. Right now there are people applying for postdocs, and I'm just waiting to see if I need to be the right person. There's an undergraduate who I don't think will go on in science, who's doing a senior project, and a technician. It's small.
How many hours a day and days a week have you spent on your science in recent years?
Oh, in recent years. You're not counting this year? I mean, in the past. Yeah, in the past, I'd say I worked most every day. And I tend to work probably 7 days a week. Not full time on the weekends, but. And most evenings. I think I've done the least amount of science the last 2 years since I looked for jobs and took a job than ever in my life. I mean, there's just a lot of just grant writing, teaching, the business of science, setting up the lab.
How many hours and days a week do you expect to be working 3 or 5 years from now?
Probably Monday through Friday, most evenings, at least a few hours, and one weekend day, at least one weekend day a week. And I actually enjoy it, but I do find that I like other things, so, and there are other necessities of life that have to be met. So in some ways I've worked less this year because I find that I work so hard when I'm working that I just have to take time off. So I do.
Two last things very quickly, Mara, since we're running out of time. One is, 10 years from now, if you got really lucky, what would you like to have done or shown scientifically? One of the streams came true.
I haven't thought about that. I suppose that I'm hoping that I will go in a more molecular direction, still keeping biological principles in mind. I mean, but that I will be finding genes that are very important in regulating development. I might add that despite all my teaching, I enjoy it immensely. I mean, which is part of the problem is that I work very hard at that.
A more trivial question that...
Oh, actually, I taught a developmental neurobiology course this year as well. Forgot.
Are you keeping your old grant proposals, correspondence, notebooks, all the stuff, the documents, what you've been up to?
My life's in total disarray.
Have you traveled with you or not? That's
here? Has what traveled with
you? As you've gone between these different places, kept all the stuff with you or not?
Well, most everything I've always had to leave. I have, from the work I did in Carla's lab, actually I have all the data analysis. I mean, I have boxes and boxes of all the analysis. She has all the material, but I have all the analysis except for she's, yeah. And so I guess I'm keeping it. I think having moved as much as I have moved, I've gotten rid of more than most people.
Well, let's hope you stay put and accumulate.
I plan to. Actually, I'm very happy there, so I plan to.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.